Welcome to Dig in the Dirt. I'm your host, Ann Goldine, and today we're going to talk about gardening. My guest is Sean Hogan. He is the owner of Sistus Nursery on Sovie Island and is also a landscape advisor and planner in Portland. Welcome, Sean.
Good morning.
So tell me, you've been doing this gardening thing for a long time now.
Since I was about three, I think.
Three? Wow. Okay. You must have had a parent who was schlepping you around in the garden.
Something like that. One parent was very much into gardening. The other grew up on a British firehouse and didn't know a dandelion from a wisteria, but that was okay. Lots of neighbors also. I was very lucky.
Uh-huh. So you grew up just like tagging along behind your mom?
That, and it was interesting. There was a wonderful rock gardener next door, and I found myself having conversations about penstemons at 4 years old, and I just thought everybody did that.
I think that's what my older daughter was like. Right. She was always doing that and identifying plants from a very early age and having preferences.
Nice.
And so then, okay, so then you got older and then somehow figured out how to make that into a living.
Exactly. Well, I think it was a complete accident, really. And I don't know if I'd advise horticulture for everybody, but it is certainly a wonderfully fulfilling thing. I mean, I think everything you do is cathartic, if not money-making.
Okay, so now, in addition to the Sistus Nursery, you have other things you do. So what are those other things?
Well, the nursery itself, it was kind of an offshoot of my design business and sort of an obsessive collection of plants, really. I'd left Oregon to go to school and then curated the University of California Botanic Garden in Berkeley, and came back to Portland in about 96. Thought, well, let's open a garden design and public garden planning business, and that's been really fun. So we started the nursery just in some 120-year-old greenhouses in Portland, to supplement what we were trying to find. And it grew completely out of control from there. But also, writing about the plants themselves, I have found, is really fun. So the various books and things that have come out, maybe they're going to serve for my lack of memory as time goes by. I could just refer to my own work as if it were somebody else's.
Okay, so how many books have you written?
Oh, a few. I think the last couple, there's a big green thing called Flora, Gardener's Encyclopedia. It weighs about 100 pounds, so it was in most of the stores. I think it's still in several. And the latest one is one called Broadleaved Evergreens, Trees for Temperate Climates, Trees for All Seasons. And it's entirely about trees, small and large, that don't lose their leaves in the winter, that are so great in warm-tempered climates. So that was the one that came out last year, and that's been pretty popular.
That is great.
Maybe not like a Daniel Steele novel, but, relatively.
Well, for people who love to learn about plants, I mean, that's a different group than the read the Daniel Steele novels.
It's true. I suppose you could do a couple at once. Why not? A little bit like flipping channels.
Well, that's true. I mean, there's like novels like The Orchid Thief that kind of blends, like a murder mystery and plants.
Exactly. Sometimes. Although, sometimes when you are looking at things like that, when you have a little knowledge about the subject, sometimes it's better to read about something you have no knowledge about. You find yourself editing. At least I do.
Yeah. Okay, now there's one other thing that we should touch on, and that is that you do some radio as well in Portland.
Well, here and there. I think when the book started coming out, I started doing more just radio interviews, which is fun. Mm-hmm. And then just occasionally on KXL in Portland, there's a wonderful, commercial station where Mike Darcy does his radio show, and I don't know what its reach is toward the coast, since there are those bumps in the way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really a lot of fun, very easy to work with. And just a few times Mike's been away and I've had to do it by myself, which was really quite frightening, actually.
Now, you said that his program is a four-hour program?
It goes, I believe it's 8 to 12, I think. I might be wrong. So if anybody listens to it on a regular basis, they can correct me.
But absolutely.
It's Saturday mornings.
That's a lot of programming. I think that's longer than any program on Coast Community Radio. I think 3 hours is the max of any one person's program.
That makes sense.
That's a lot of programming to do. Especially when it's tuck, and you said people call in. So right. You have these live, spontaneous conversations where you have to come up with answers right now?
Exactly. So, you know, not even I can usually talk that much.
Okay, so Portland just had its garden show.
Yes.
And you built a garden there?
We did. It was really, in retrospect, I can say it was a lot of fun. Yesterday we were still a little sore.
I'm sure it was a ton of work.
It was, but when, you know, tens of people see it, and hopefully you've done a good job, there are a lot of good vendors and interesting gardens there. We did one that I really enjoyed, and it was gardening with plants that love it here. So essentially things that need very little care, you know, natives, some things from the Southwest, and some, for instance, Australian plants that, they're what I call tough love plants. They mm-hmm. love bad soil, full exposure, no compost, no fertilizer, and no supplemental water. And, you know, a lot of people might think, well, that sounds easy. But, you know, what I've found over the years is, you know, I think it's a lot more difficult not to nurture a garden than it is to nurture it, if that makes sense.
Mm.
And everything you pick up says, you know, add compost, water all the time. And it's hard not to. It's like, you know, not feeding your puppy.
All right, so why don't you give us a short list of the plants in that category that love that kind of abuse, soil and
absolutely.
Water.
For instance, think native, and we didn't use a madrone, an arbutus, in it, but we did use some of their relatives, the manzanitas,
mm-hmm.
which the one of our towns is named.
Mm-hmm.
A whole bunch of different types, and we had some that were about 10 feet tall. So if you know the manzanitas, those beautiful, anywhere from green to silver leaves, they're all in flower in the winter, and with the beautiful peachy little bell-shaped flowers. And the trunks and the stems are this muscular sort of teak mahogany to orange color, just stunning plants.
Mm-hmm.
And out of context, you'd think it's the most exotic thing in the world.
Well, I've never seen one that was 10 feet tall.
Well, there's some types in the interior. This was one called Visita, from the Willamette Valley down into the Sacramento Valley. It doesn't grow on the coast. Native, it would grow there if you planted it. And, you know, it's really interesting that the reactions to it were, oh, my goodness, that's the most beautiful manzanita I've ever seen, to, I used to clear that when I lived in Redding.
Oh, God.
So.
Yeah. Okay.
Does it burn well? Well, yeah, I suppose.
It doesn't have a lot of resin in it?
I think they have some.
Mm-hmm.
They're, you know, mostly... they burn when you have a whole bunch of dead foliage or, you know, dead twigs and things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you've got a 1,000-degree fire coming at it.
But right,
we
right.
don't suggest that around your house.
Right, like Bend.
Right, exactly.
They get a lot of that with the manzanita going up with everything else, the pines.
Yes.
Okay, what else?
Oh, goodness. You know, a lot of our native ceanothus, the California lilac or the blue bush,
mm-hmm.
You know, there are several types native in Oregon, especially along the coast, but... so many of them are just absolutely bulletproof shrubs, and they love coastal wind and that kind of thing.
And they can also be a nice hedge.
Yeah, exactly. They're sort of the native version of Escalonia, really, mm-hmm. as far as hedging goes.
Mm-hmm.
They're tough. We're growing one now that actually a friend found near Cape Blanco, and it was windblown in a beautiful little mound there, but out of the real world, it turned into a small tree. And he actually named it Oregon Mist. And it's been important for us when we find new things in the wild that we think are worthy of putting in our gardens, we really try to give local names to them.
Mm.
And not like Brenda, but I mean, you know, because we want people to understand, you know, kind of equate their own native plants, our own native plants, with where we live.
Mm-hmm.
So that one's named Oregon Mist.
Oh, that sounds
and
great.
It makes a 15-foot small tree, little evergreen leaves, very shiny, sky blue flowers in sort of February through June and then scattered the rest of the year.
Mm.
And it's vase-shaped, but the trunk is, the wood is green or the bark is green. So it really, some of the prettiest things we've got are our own, in our own backyard, literally.
And this is something people can buy, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Okay. Next.
Oh, next. All right.
I'm making a list here.
Oh, okay. Excellent. I heard the scratching. Well, you know, another funny thing, people don't grow very often. They cut, you know, like anything, they come and grow from popularity.
Mm-hmm.
But our own coast silk tassel, the Garia elliptica, it grows all the way from, I think it's Ventura County to just a little bit north of, somewhere in Tillamook County, I think, is the northern extent. And evergreen shrub, pretty round leaves. They get, you know, about 10 feet tall, so it's a background creature. But at this time of the year, from December through now, are these foot-long catkins, these little long florets, and there are thousands of them. And with every bit of wind, they move. So it's kind of like going into a gypsy parlor, you know, with the... I guess I don't do that very often, but...
Right, with the beads.
The beads and the silk tassels.
Mm-hmm.
But it really is wonderful when you have a shrub... or a tree that has that kind of movement. So Garia elliptica, and there are a whole bunch of different named types of them. So, I mean, you know, there's so many good, just plain, a lot of Garias. There are about a gazillion, both our ceanothus and our manzanitas, or our anarctaphylos. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of named forms. So the nice thing is you can get one that grows 4 inches tall, or 15 feet tall. So, yeah, definitely read the label.
Right, right. If you need something that's short, don't get the tall one.
Yes, exactly. And that's one thing. We talked a lot to people that were coming through the show. I love that, but can I prune it? And the answer, of course, is yes. But so many of those things have such beautiful form, especially the branching pattern of the manzanitas. So we really highly recommend, if you can, getting a plant that gets about as high as you'd like it to.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they completely stop, but you don't have to do major cutting and sort of ruin its beautiful shape.
Well, right. Yeah, if you get the right size plant, then you shouldn't have to do a whole lot to it.
Yeah,
exactly. I mean, if you're having to do heavy pruning, you got the wrong plant.
Right. And, you know, we're all guilty of that, especially when you want instant filler. And if it takes 22 years to get to the height you want it to, then, you know, it's okay to plant something that's fast growing and deal with it later.
Oh, God, yes.
But better to know that you're going to do that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, one of the other things we used also, another group of plants, were the a lot of Australian creatures, and especially for coastal areas and places that we, you know, in the garden that we're not going to give a whole bunch of fertilizer to, and I know they're becoming more popular, things like the grevilleas, wonderful shrubs, and they really do heart the coast. Many more kinds will do there than we'll do here in the interior.
Is there a common name?
Yeah, pretty much grevillea.
Oh, okay.
There aren't very many common names for some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are, they're in a language that's even less common than Latin.
Mm.
So I think, I'm not thinking of any others. And a few of the tree forms have common names, but that would really throw us off.
Mm-hmm.
But grevillea kind of rolls off the tongue if you've said it a few times.
Okay.
So, you know, I'd suggest using it in a sentence a few times today.
Okay.
And
I'm going on a hunt for grevilleas.
There we go. your eyes are the color of grevillea or something like that. But they're, for the most part...
Can you name a couple more of the Australian plants
that
you'd recommend?
Well, absolutely.
Okay.
One of them, and this is more of a... We use them for pot plants here, but occasionally on the coldest of winters they get a bit nuked. But the Coreas... They're called Australian fuchsias, and they have nothing to do with fuchsias, actually. They're in the orange family. But they're winter flowering, beautiful leaves, usually kind of covered with fur. And the buds look like little acorns, but then they open up into these bell shapes.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be anywhere from orange through pinks through almost chartreuse.
Mm-hmm.
And they're amazing. And if you live right on the beach, nothing will ever hurt them. You know, if you live in the interior... then if it's going to drop below 20, pull them in and stick them in the garage or something for a day or two.
You are listening to Dig in the Dirt. I'm Ann Goldin, and I'm talking today with Sean Hogan. He is the owner of Sistis Nursery and does a lot of landscape design work in Portland. Okay, so when we left, we were talking about, you were saying that below 20 degrees, the Coreas... die, and
or
you know
they get a little damaged, and so worth kind of protecting them if that happens.
Okay, and what kind of protection are you talking about? Blankets?
a blanket, or you know, a lot of people now are using them as sort of front porch plants because they are so attractive all winter. They flower from about October through April or May, and then a little bit all the time. So, well worth doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the Cymbidium orchids, that kind of thing. A lot of people use them as front porch plants.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if it does get cold, they're easily brought in if they're in a container, and then just stuck out 2 days later.
I bought a bunch of huge Cymbidiums, and I couldn't bring them in this winter.
Oh.
A couple of them died. I mean, they're not outside. They're in this sort of unheated, I don't know what it is, like a shed that's got glass around it.
Right.
Two of them died. One of the really big ones died.
Oh.
One of the small ones died. But a couple of them didn't die, so I'm hoping that they'll make it.
You know, there a lot of them are hardy into the 20s, and there are a whole bunch that are actually hardy in the ground, both in the Willamette Valley and along the coast.
Really?
They tend
Cymbidiums?
To be smaller. Cymbidiums.
Whoa.
They are, right now, they're in flower at the nursery in the greenhouses, and they're subtle, but the markings are beautiful. They, you know, all these wonderful greens and sort of red markings. Some of them are yellow or white, and they smell like, oh, I don't know if you ever put a bowl of lemons or in the kitchen to make everything smell good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you walk into the area, and it smells like the world of the bowl of lemons.
Mm.
So there's one called Cymbidium sinensis, the Chinese one,
mm-hmm.
and another one called Goringii. So there they are, but wonderful plants. And in a little bit of a shade garden underneath the neglected camellia, that kind of thing, they're good garden plants.
Mm. God, that's a great...
How about that for an aside?
I like it. I love Cymbidiums. It's, you know, it's a kind of orchid, and I'm sort of an orchid nut, so
yeah.
that sounds good to me.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's talk about hardiness in general. This winter, we in December had, in Astoria at least, we had some pretty freezy days, and a lot of plants just kind of shriveled up. Like
yeah.
All the leaves on my Daphne, Daphne Odora,
right,
just sort of fried off.
Exactly. Go ahead.
Well, and now I've got lots of new leaves, and it didn't die, but I thought it might die.
And the same thing happened in Portland, of course, being closer to the lovely yet treacherous Columbia Gorge. We got the very cold air through, and it was just a bad set of scenarios. But we out on Savi Island, we went down to near 10 degrees, which
Ooh.
I don't know if that's ever happened before, but at least in modern history. So we had a little testing going on in the garden this year.
Did you lose a lot of things at the garden?
You know, I'd say maybe, I'll bet we had about a 10% loss,
uh-huh.
like that, which isn't too bad. Most of what we consider the big furniture didn't die. But, goodness, there were a few eucalyptus we were experimenting with, and of maybe the 30 or so species in the garden, only two don't look good, and they are now firewood for next winter.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of a rule of thumb. If it looks bad after winter, it's out of there.
Uh-huh.
But really, the Daphnes, even in the coldest spots here, some of them lost leaves, but they're all in flower, which is a nice thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other Daphnes that I have, they're fine.
Yeah.
They didn't care at all. I don't know that I actually lost anything else this year.
It's, you know, it was, and especially along the coast, it was rather, well, it was very brief. It was only three nights, really, that were particularly cold.
Uh-huh.
And of course, we haven't even been appreciably below 40 since, which is totally unfair, but probably typical of a cold snap in Western Oregon.
Right, and who knows? Any day we could drop down again and have some more crud, even though the plums think it's spring.
Exactly. They seem to be right on time. The second week of February seems to be the height, and our records now go down into the upper 20s, even in the interior. Probably, I would not suspect a frost anywhere on the coast, especially after this. But it's, you know, if you're talking about sort of temperatures and plants,
mm-hmm.
I like to, it can be really scary for people, especially if they're just getting into gardening. It's sort of like learning football in 2 days and deciding you're going to be, you know, mm-hmm. having to sit in front of a television.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a strange analysis, and so I don't think I've ever seen a football game. But a good thing to remember is there are a couple of different sets of zones. One of them is the sunset zones, and the other is the United States Department of Agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
So just good to, you know, get a little bit of information on both. A lot of books have them, sort of gardening books have them in the front cover. and just kind of think about those temperatures. And sometimes the zones we live in become almost intuitive, and that's kind of fun. Like most of the north coast of Oregon is zone 5 in sunset, and that has a whole bunch of characteristics, like not very much summer heat, but mild winter temperatures. And yet you just go inland, and you get maybe a little more cold, but you get lots of heat.
Mm-hmm.
And things like that are very important for what they call ripening, and it's not just ripening a tomato, but ripening wood on things. And so sometimes, for instance, with olives, we've been giving or selling olives to a lot of people that live on the coast lately, and what we tell people is they actually seem to do very well there, but stop watering them midsummer.
Oh, because, like figs.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing, and it's it'll just make sure they slow down a little bit, kind of harden off, as they say,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to sail through the winter much more easily. Friends of ours have citrus, actually, in Silex, and they stop watering about the end of August, and that really does help.
Is the citrus in the ground?
Yeah.
Oh, at the beach?
At the beach, and just a little bit inland.
Are we talking like oranges and lemons?
They're growing Meyer.
Oh, okay. They're hardier.
Yeah, a little tougher.
Okay, so basically the higher the number in the hardiness, what does that mean?
Well, you know, for instance, most of the coast around Brookings up to, you know, sort of Cape Blanco, and that area is zone 10, which means their lowest temperatures in the winter are going to be, say, 30 to 35.
Mm-hmm.
So if a frost of any sort is rare down there. When you get to the northern Oregon coast, you're in 9B. So the average coldest temperature is going to be, you know, not much below 30. But a good thing to remember there, and you know, Portland is sort of 8 and 9, depending on where you are in the Willamette Valley.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little lower, and they're in 10-degree increments. So zone 9 is the lowest point in the winter would be 20 to 30 degrees. 8 is 10 to 20. And again, it's a little bit of a game at first, and then it just sort of like a new language. It just sort of pops into your head when you think of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the main thing to remember there is that these are averages. So if you're going to plant a tree, we say, you know, plant it for a 30-year event, as they say. So if, say, Astoria in 1990 went to 13 or 14 degrees, I would plant something that would be hardy to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you plant a Hebe and it gets nuked every 10 years, it costs $10 to plant another one. But trees are a different story, both emotionally and expensive. So,
yes, we're still mourning the loss of our eucalyptus tree.
Exactly. So, you know, good to... And again, doing the research on the hardiness of things can be really fun. Sometimes frustrating because, as you know, searching the web for information can be really good information or completely off the top of someone's head.
Right, so, but if you go to a site like Oregon State or Washington State University's sites, they're all science-based, and you can get
right.
information that you can trust.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And go to more than one, because you learn all kinds of things about the plants.
Mm-hmm.
And the one person, you know, if it's a Southern California nursery, they might say extremely hardy to 25 degrees, whereas someone up here has had it to 15 degrees, and we can give you a little more information.
Oh, right. Yeah, because they only know what they've got.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is, of course, the case with all of us.
That's true. Okay.
So zones can be fun, and climate can be fun. And I just try to get people to treat it more like kind of a fun sport than something that's scary.
Well, and you certainly do that at the nursery with your whole section of all those tropical or sort of tropical things.
Well, kind of a fun thing to do is we thought long ago that we would divide the nursery kind of geographically. So we've got a native section, Mediterranean, so both of those want dry summers. Things from Asia, like jasmines, gardenias, camellias, you name it, all of those things want rain. I have to have water in the summer, so those sections we water. And then sort of, you know, the bold foliage sections, which some are tropical and some aren't, but sometimes the tags are a little extreme, but, you know, we tend to write a mini novel on each label, just so people can get, you know, what they'd like from it. And so, you know, at least you leave it sort of caveat emptor with a little help.
Right, as opposed to when you buy a native, you're going to be pretty safe.
Well, hopefully, but even that, you know, if you think of what we call native, it could be from 5,000 feet at government camp, or from a place on the coast that's never gotten a frost, or desert to, you know, to rainforest. So even then, you know, it's always good to try to practice right plant, right place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where does it come from, and what do I have in my garden, or what can I make in my garden that that can at least make it think it's at home.
Right, make it happy.
Yeah.
Not put the wrong thing. Okay, you told me last night that there are some really cool bulbs and flowers, new things. So just give me some little tantalizing morsels.
Oh, you know what? I think it's funny. And bulbs, for instance, at a nursery like ours, people have to get there at the right time. And sometimes, I love winter flowering things.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we have, you know, 3 customers a day in the winter, and I want everybody to be seeing these things, that's kind of why we went into mail order. Like, all right, at least we can, you know, put up a picture on the website and tell people a story, and they don't have to trudge out there. But, you know, things like the genus Iphion, Iphion,
mm-hmm.
They're actually little onion relatives, but with inch across flowers. They were sort of they're sort of a very pale bluish white one that's been in gardens for years. But there are some that have not been around. There's one called Rolf Fiedler that we used in the garden show. So we combined under some bright blue yuccas, we put a Liberdia, which is an iris relative, but it spreads like a perennial.
Mm.
And especially the winter leaves are sort of a screaming rust, almost fluorescent orange.
Wow.
So a beautiful little upright iris, evergreen, little white flowers in the spring. And between those bright orange leaves, we put these Iphions that are in flower now. And there's one called Rolf Fiedler that is the most intriguing sky blue color. And, you know, it looks like, think of a little puddle in a bright green meadow on a spring day when that water is reflecting the blue sky.
Mm.
So that in combination was awfully pretty.
Mm-hmm. That sounds beautiful.
Those Iphions are really wonderful. There are also a whole bunch of new gladiolus.
Mm.
And, you know, we're used to seeing the gladiolus you can get at a nursery or a box store for the large flowers that they use mostly for funerals, I think, but I don't know what else.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But there are a whole bunch of little delicate species ones. And they're just absolutely intriguing. One of them that's actually pretty widely available now is one called Gladiolus tristis. I guess it would be called the sad gladiolus.
Yes, I think it would.
It's got a chartreuse to cream flower in mid to late spring. Just tiny little filaments of leaves. It gets about 2 feet tall. And right at dusk, it completely fills the garden with the most heady fragrance.
Mm.
So, you know, there are things like that.
Mm-hmm.
There are even, you know, Muscari, the grape hyacinth.
Mm-hmm.
There's one called Macrocarpa. And it's from Crete, just a couple of islands. Very large leaves that can actually stay evergreen.
Mm.
They almost look like a little aloe. And the flowers are about a foot tall. They are golden yellow going to sort of almost a burgundy at the very bottom. And well, extremely fragrant.
Unfortunately, we are at the end of our time. I would love to keep going on this. You have been listening to Dig in the Dirt. My guest is Sean Hogan. He is the owner of Sistis Nursery on Sovies Island. And go visit. Give your web address.
It is info, at sistus.com.
And cistus.com.
Right.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.